From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Lori London reporting. There's word from the White House that President Donald Trump has approved a plan to impose harsh tariffs on Chinese goods imported into the U.S. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
It was a Trump campaign pledge to try to even the trade imbalance between the two countries, and it follows allegations that Beijing steals or pressures foreign companies to hand over technology. China's been planning retaliatory tariffs, and this economic struggle could interfere with diplomatic efforts to get North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The UN General Assembly adopted a resolution this week calling for protection for Palestinian civilians living under Israeli occupation after the U.S. blocked a similar measure in the Security Council. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley rebuked the General Assembly for using its time to criticize Israel instead of addressing other situations.
The nature of this resolution clearly demonstrates that politics is driving the day. It is totally one-sided. It makes not one mention of Hamas, who routinely initiates violence in Gaza.
While the resolution does not explicitly name Hamas, it does condemn all acts of violence against civilians, including acts of terror. AT&T, the number two wireless carrier, Thursday closed its $85 billion deal to acquire media company Time Warner, Inc., after U.S. antitrust regulators indicated they would not seek a delay. The deal was opposed by President Donald Trump. AT&T was sued by the Trump Justice Department, but won approval from a judge to move forward with the deal on Tuesday following a six-week trial. This is VOA. People around the United States hit the streets protesting separating children from their parents at the U.S. border. Under the recently announced zero-tolerance policy of President Trump's administration, children and parents who cross the border together are separated. That's because the adult, at least temporarily, is being placed in a detention facility, while current law says children have to be placed in the least restrictive setting. Republican House members are crafting an immigration bill that would end family separations as the U.S. plans to reopen a tent shelter to house migrant children. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
This measure sticks to President Trump's priorities on immigration while trying to get conservatives and moderates on board. It's a shift to a merit-based system. The young Dreamers, who have been living in the country illegally since childhood, could apply for legal status for 6 years. Applicants could gain points for education or other skills. Eventually, they could apply for citizenship. The bill beefs up enforcement of immigration laws and ends the diversity visa lottery for immigrants from underrepresented countries. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The Justice Department's internal watchdog is set to release a report into one of the most consequential FBI investigations in recent history, the Hillary Clinton email probe. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
The watchdog says there's no evidence conclusions by Comey or department prosecutors were tinged by politics or a preference for either Clinton or Donald Trump, meaning there are no conclusions to back Republicans and Democrats who want to claim the report vindicates them. Both have complained about Comey's actions during the race. The watchdog says the then-director's actions were insubordinate and extraordinary.
That's Sagar Magani reporting. A New York lawsuit accuses President Trump's foundation of repeated violations of state law. AP correspondent Warren Levinson has that story.
The lawsuit charges Trump used the money contributed to his charitable foundation to pay his legal bills, promote his properties, and make personal purchases. Acting Attorney General Barbara Underwood says the Trump Foundation was little more than a checkbook for payments from Trump or his businesses to nonprofits, regardless of their purpose or legality. This is not how private foundations should function, she says. Underwood also charged the foundation illegally spent millions on Trump's presidential campaign. The president tweeted that it's a ridiculous case. Warren Levinson, New York.
The Football World Cup kicked off Thursday with host Russia defeating Saudi Arabia 5-0 in the opening match of the tournament. On Friday, Egypt takes on Uruguay. Morocco faces Iran and Portugal and squares off with Spain. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Friday, June the 15th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. Health experts are dispatching an experimental vaccine in areas of the Democratic Republic of the Congo that are considered ground zero in the fight against Ebola. And Uganda's government passed an ambitious $8.6 billion budget for the financial year 2018-2019. The budget will be financed by revenue collections, including a new tax on social media.
The non-tax revenue collection for this year is estimated at $430.4 billion against the target of $308 billion.
Uganda's Minister of Finance, Matia Kasaija. The son of the founding father of Zambia's ruling party, Patriotic Front, PF, has rejoined the group after defecting from the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND. And today marks the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan as Muslims worldwide celebrate the end of fasting. Muslims in Burundi say the month of Ramadan helped them strengthen the relations in their community. And menstruation often means missing school for many girls in parts of Africa. But experts ask, should the state provide sanitary products to girls who can't afford them to prevent them from falling behind in their studies? That question continues to stir debate in several East African countries, but especially in Kenya.
No girl will have an excuse of not going to school just because they lack sanitary pads.
Rachel Owuko is the Nairobi Program Coordinator for FEM International, a non-profit organization that provides sanitary products to underprivileged girls in Kenya and Tanzania. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Health experts are dispatching an experimental vaccine in areas of the Democratic Republic of the Congo that are considered ground zero in the fight against Ebola. Their hope is to try to combat the outbreak from the onset. The crucial test is providing hope in times of uncertainty. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo is grappling with its ninth outbreak of Ebola, and health experts are scrambling to dispatch an experimental vaccine to fight the deadly virus in its earliest stages. While the vaccine has yet to be approved, health officials have rushed in 7,500 doses because the shots appeared promising during the devastating 2014 Ebola epidemic in West Africa. The vaccines are being dispensed in three of the country's most heavily affected areas, all of which are transport hubs. The strategy involves investigators working in rings around those who've been infected, immunizing high-risk people who've come into direct contact with infected persons, and then with their contacts. Dr. Michael Yao is with the World Health Organization.
From most of the positive cases that we have, at least 50% are coming from the contact.
Dr. Isa Sigelnecki with Doctors Without Borders says the strategy's success hinges on the speed at which health workers can identify people at risk.
If we identify the new case before the disease progresses, then we can treat the patient in the hospital.
Even if the vaccine works, the hurdles can be challenging. Special freezers are needed to transport the medication in the heat and through forested areas with few paved roads. Health workers have to identify and track down anyone who's come into contact with a sick person. And perhaps most challenging of all is persuading a frightened population that these shots can save lives. UNICEF's Rija Andriamihantanrina says many don't believe Ebola even exists.
The community was not really convinced that this is a deadly disease. For them, it's a story of witchcraft and so on.
Health officials say that while it's difficult to track down people in remote areas who are at risk and in need of vaccination, they're cautiously optimistic about the strategy in more populated areas. Passengers who arrive in boats have their temperature taken. And in populated areas along the Congo River, residents are given a phone number to report anyone who's become sick. Local resident Jules Mongabongo.
Here we wait. As soon as it happens, we'll call, since we were left numbers. They will come directly with drugs to spray in the boats.
Health experts say the next 2 weeks will be critical in determining if the outbreak is under control. The World Health Organization predicted there could be up to 300 cases of Ebola in the coming months. A large study is underway that will compare this vaccine with a second vaccine candidate. In the meantime, some recipients say at the very least, the shot gives them peace of mind. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
And in Liberia, this year's national budget, which is currently in draft form and has not yet been passed for the first time, is scheduled to put aside money for mental health care in the country. Kate Smart, Medecins Sans Frontières Mental Health Project Coordinator, spoke with Ricky Shryok about the vast shortages of mental health professionals and medication in the country.
When it comes to psychiatry, there is one Liberian psychiatrist in country, and he has been around for many years and is allegedly going to retire soon. So as far as a Liberian-based psychiatrist, that is the totality of it. There are many others that have been trained. They're called mental health clinicians. The Carter Center has done quite a large initiative to do training. And they've trained over 200 people in mental health. It's a six-month training that takes place. They've been doing for the past couple of years and are still engaged in. There are people that are receiving training, but the problem comes with follow-up. So once the training is done, the six-month sort of engagement in mental health, some of these people are then placed in primary health care centers, but there are often a vast lack of resources related to drugs and then ongoing training.
This shortage of drugs, when you say that there's a lack of medication available for Liberians, can you tell me in more detail what that is, what that means?
So the drug shortage has been ongoing for a while. And I'm going to speak directly to psychotropics, but that and anti-epileptics, because that's what we typically deal with. But the mental health has not had actually a budget line with the Ministry of Health until last year. Mental health did get a budget line last year, but no money was entered into it. This year in the draft budget, there is money that is allotted for mental health, but again, it's the draft budget and still remains to be confirmed.
How much is it at this time?
Draft budget that I saw, which was a few weeks ago, was around $1.1 million for the entire country. I believe it was in U.S. dollars.
When the government isn't budgeting for this kind of care, how does that affect the drug supply?
So the drug supply itself is again, incredibly inconsistent and inadequate because of the lack of resources. I mean, they just aren't on hand. So the government typically relies on donations from other parties to fulfill those needs. So many clinics, if someone would happen to turn up to a clinic where there was a mental health clinician present to be treated for epilepsy or another mental health issue, the drugs necessary, it would be quite likely they would not be available, which presents a major issue in actually receiving any kind of continuity of treatment.
Hey, what kind of stigma surrounds mental health in Liberia?
Stigma is a tremendous issue and one that is pervasive. I think you will find that within populations that are more urban or rural. And there's a long tradition of this. You see the stigma is directed towards people with epilepsy as well as with people with mental health. So there's a perception that these issues or conditions are a cause of witchcraft. Someone has been cursed. And also there's a perception that it could be contagious. So stigma is very deep-seated and contributes to a lot of other issues for the individual and for the families that are dealing with people that are presenting with mental health conditions.
That was Kate Smart, Medecins Sans Frontières Mental Health Project Coordinator. She was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Monrovia. And in more budget news, the government of Uganda yesterday passed an ambitious 32.7 billion Uganda shillings budget, which is $8.6 billion for the financial year 2018-2019. The budget will be financed by revenue collections, exports, as well as both domestic and foreign borrowing to fund the budget. Uganda's parliament recently imposed a tax on the use of social media in a bid to raise more revenue. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
While presenting the budget for the financial year 2018-2019 to the parliament this Thursday, Finance Minister Matia Kaseja said the government will expand its tax base by introducing new taxes. The new taxes will include, among others, tax on mobile money, excise duty on cooking oil, a 15% duty tax on all juices, excise duty on diesel and petrol, as well as a 200 shillings levy on internet.
Total tax and non-tax revenue is estimated to amount to 14.4 trillion this ending financial year. Over the past decade, tax revenue has been growing at an average rate of 17% per annum, rising from 3.2 trillion in financial year 2007-2008. Madam Speaker, the non-tax revenue collection for this year is estimated at 430.4 billion against the target of 308 billion.
Uganda's President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni said Uganda is on the right track to development. Museveni said the only way to develop Uganda is by encouraging mechanized farming.
Those people of yours who are just engaged in agriculture for only eating, those people, we need to pull them out. So that's where the poverty is, the poverty you're talking about. So commercialization of agriculture. Don't talk about too many things. Concentrate on that in your constituency. Parish by parish.
Museveni said farmers in the country will be helped to use irrigation and fertilizers to increase yields. However, parliamentary members of the opposition boycotted the budget presentation. Winfred Chiza, the leader of opposition in the parliament, described Thursday's presentation as just ceremonial.
Really, you can't keep calling me a killer and you invite me to your home and you think I'll just show up. Museveni just the other day called us killers. So supposing anything happens to him in that house and they think it is us who have killed him.
While addressing mourners of a Roman inspired member of parliament who was murdered last week, President Museveni suggested the murder of the ruling party member could have been politically motivated. Chiza says the opposition will continue to monitor how the country's resources are used by the government. For VOA News, I am Mugume. Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Thank you, Mugume. And from Uganda, we go to Zambia, where the son of the founding father of Zambia's ruling party, Patriotic Front, PF, has rejoined the group after defecting from the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND. Announcing his return Thursday, Mulenga Sata, son of former President Michael Sata, says he plans to represent the ruling party to contest the Lusaka mayor position. Sata resigned from the PF in 2016 after President Edgar Lungu appointed him as the Lusaka province minister. For analysis on this latest political development in Zambia, VOA's Peter Cloti reached Alex Ngoma, a political science lecturer at the University of Zambia.
The tragedy of our politics is that we do not seem to have a statesman for politicians. What Mulenga Sata has done is a clear manifestation of pursuit of self-interest. Most of our politicians, I would say, are warm weather politicians. They will always move to a party that they think is likely to form government. When Mulenga Sata went to the UPND, his calculation that time was that the UPND was really poised to win the 2016 general elections. But since the UPND failed to win the elections, then Mulenga Sata has now found it necessary to ditch the United Party for National Development and cross back to the Patriotic Front, the party in government, because he knows that this party will be in office until 2021, when elections will be held again.
Why is this so acceptable in Zambia and other parts of Africa, particularly when they party hop from one party to the other, shamelessly, some people say?
That is a clear demonstration also of the weaknesses of our constitutions as Africans, because the constitution does not bar a person from leaving one political party and going to another, and at the same time, you know, contest an existing political position. Mulenga Sata has moved very quickly at this time from the United Party for National Development to the Patriotic Frank the party was a member of initially, because he wants to be adopted as a candidate for the mayor of the city of Lusaka. So that is the tragedy of our politics. We have warm weather politicians, people who always move very quickly to where they see an opportunity for personal gain and gratification, rather than an opportunity to save the people.
Why are Zambians tolerant of this? Because some people suggest that this prevents others from having the opportunity to represent their party, because his father was the former president and the founder of the ruling Patriotic Front Party.
That is, I've said, is actually very true. Number one is that the Zambian constitution does not bar a person from crossing from one political party to another at any time. Number two is that Mulenga Sata is really, you know, looking for a chance to be adopted as a mayoral candidate on the Patriotic Front ticket. It is unfortunate that the constitution allows people to do that. And if it does, then it becomes very, very difficult for an ordinary Zambian to stand up and stop that and fight that and speak against it. We may condemn that kind of practice all we want, but at the end of the day, the man has an opportunity, because it is his democratic and the constitutional right to change. But also, I think one issue people are not raising is the fact that those in the ruling party would like to be seen to be unified. You're talking about a man who is a son of the former president of the Republic of Zambia and the founding father of the party in government. So it is really a question of gaining sympathy and trying to put on the heart of a unifier for a political party. That is what the Patriotic Front has done. But I'd like to speculate further and say that Mulenga Sata didn't actually do that by himself. He must have been enticed by some bigwigs in the Patriotic Front that he should come back, because if he did, then he would be considered for adoption as a mayoral candidate. That, I think, must have happened somewhere.
What do you think his chances are to win the by-election to become the Lusaka mayor?
Should he be adopted as a candidate, then I'm afraid his chances will be high, because, again, the weakness in our politics is that there will be this government machinery behind him to market him, to support him, and people will be persuaded that they will, in fact, be voting for the party, not necessarily the individual. And from that perspective, he may just win and become, you know, the next mayor of the city of Lusaka. So the point I'm trying to emphasize is simply that people here will be somehow untwisted by the, you know, government machinery that will be behind this man, that will speak for this man, that will build his image, you know, trying to cover up his misdeeds and portray him as a good candidate just because he belongs to, you know, the party government.
That was Alex Ngoma, a political science lecturer at the University of Zambia. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti. And menstruation often means missing school for many girls in parts of Africa. But should the government provide sanitary products to girls who can't afford them to prevent them from falling behind in their studies? That question continues to stir debate in several East African countries, but especially in Kenya, where President Uhuru Kenyatta last year signed the Basic Education Amendment Act, requiring the government to provide free sanitary towels to schoolgirls. Rayer Ombur has more on this from Nairobi.
A 2016 UN report estimated that 1 in 10 girls in sub-Saharan Africa misses school during her menstrual cycle due to an inability to access affordable sanitary products. After 2 years of debate, Kenya's parliament voted overwhelmingly last year in favor of a measure that advocates say lifts that barrier to education. In June of 2017, President Kenyatta signed the amendment into law. This May, Gender Affairs Cabinet Secretary Margaret Kobia cleared the way for the distribution of 1 million sanitary towels to girls in Kenya's Makueni and Kitui counties. The government said it targeted more than 200,000 school girls for distribution as part of a pilot program. Through funds provided by the government and channeled through the county governments, the new law is said to benefit girls in all of Kenya's 47 counties. The government allocated $4.6 million to the Gender Department Ministry to buy the towels. Rachel Owuko is the Nairobi Program Coordinator for FEM International, a non-profit organization that provides menstrual cups and reusable washable pads to underprivileged girls in Kenya and Tanzania.
If that system can actually work very well, then it will have a great impact on school girls. First, you know that it's free education, so no girl should have an excuse or no of not going to school. And then there are free sanitary pads, so every girl will... No girl will have an excuse of not going to school just because they lack sanitary pads.
Activists around the region say the issue is most pronounced in rural areas and the problem is more complex than just supplying sanitary pads. In 2017, the UN Children's Fund estimated around 60% of girls in Uganda missed class because their schools lacked private toilets and washing facilities to help them manage during their periods. Regina Kasebe is a Uganda social worker with Action Alliance, also known as Solidarity Uganda.
Issues of women and girls like cut across nations, cut across races. And you find that in school, when these young girls, most of them, they come from poor families in the schools where we majorly work with. And the challenge they have is when it stays for menstruation, because they don't have sanitary towels, they don't even use anything. So for those days, you have to stay home. You don't go to school because you can't go to school when such a situation. So there's a missing school for the days of menstruation, but there's also the fact that they drop out, they get frustrated because they can't continue handling the same issue over and over again.
She said girls in rural areas are more likely to be married off once they have started menstruating, further contributing to dropout rates. Several African nations have taken steps to improve access to sanitary products for both women and girls. Uganda announced in 2017 that sanitary pads would be exempt from value-added tax, and in November, Kenya removed duties on raw materials used in the production of sanitary pads to help make the product more affordable. According to Sustainable Health Enterprises, an NGO, 18% of women and girls in Rwanda missed work or school last year because they could not afford to buy menstrual pads. The NGO estimates that a lack of affordable sanitary pads costs Rwanda's economy $150 million per year. Activists hope other countries in the region will follow Kenya's example and take steps to make sanitary products more accessible and thus helping girls overcome a big disadvantage they have been facing at school. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And from Nairobi, we go to Johannesburg, South Africa, where police in the country are under pressure to curb violent attacks on armored vehicles which transport cash around the country. Highly organized gangs have been targeting these vehicles and are making off with large sums of cash. Since the beginning of the year, 180 cases have been recorded and millions of dollars have been lost. The gangs are often armed with powerful weapons and bombs. Nadia Sami in Johannesburg caught up with a criminologist, Dr. Marongonolo Tobane, who has interviewed over 40 convicted cash-in-transit robbers who are currently behind bars.
In my research, I found out from my participants that even though they get convicted or arrested, they do not get rehabilitated because they say that the rehabilitation programs at the correctional services basically are not useful for them, and also the fact that they are not willing to be rehabilitated as well. Those offenders who were incarcerated are released without being rehabilitated and thus continue committing the crime.
That is Dr. Marongonolo Tobane in Johannesburg, South Africa. She is a criminologist who interviewed 40 convicted cash-in-transit robbers for her research. She was speaking to VOA's Nadia Sami. And that's it for this Friday, June the 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Mvunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good weekend, Africa.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk.
Join me Monday for another exciting edition of Your Show. Our topic will be men's grooming. This is next Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.